Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. I'd like to welcome Samir Shagill to the Reboot Chronicles. He's the CEO and co-founder of Highbeam, an integrated banking, capital, and cash planning platform that is rebooting old school banking. And as you know, I've got some opinions on that. They're part of what I think we used to call the neo-banking sector of fintech. So Highbeam is very focused on helping businesses operate with more agility and insights so they can make smarter decisions with access to hopefully more responsive services and capital, of course, to ensure that they're profitable and an ongoing entity and also achieve their financial and growth goals. So quite a mouthful there. But Samir, good to see you.
Dean, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm always curious about, you know, we've had a couple couple of companies in the fintech sector on over the years, and it's always interesting to watch, you know, what's hot and what's not. But let's just start with, you know, the elephant in the room here, which is what is wrong with banking today, especially big banking? And it's ripe for a reboot. We haven't had too many of the big bank CEOs on yet on the program. Hopefully after this one, they still will want to be. But it seems like an easy category to poke fun at, but and I mean you've been doing this for a while now. What do you think's wrong, and what needs to happen?
Yeah, well, it's there's many different ways to kind of target that question. I think that, you know, banking to me has always been an interesting relationship. Let's start there, because at the end of the day, banking for the most part is a very trusted relationship where you're trusting your business or your own money with someone, right? And that's like the core of it. What's interesting about banking is I think like it's almost gone backwards. Like look at 30, 40, 50 years ago, you'd have a community banker that actually knew you, that knew your business, that you would go and talk to, that actually helped you with some sort of advice around how to do things. And then over time with the consolidation, what's happened is, you know, large banks have focused mainly on regulation, balance sheet risk, all the things behind the scenes they have to do to give you trust, yep. And the government providing you trust, your money is safe. But what that's caused is the stasis in products. Like every banking service is a commodity. Like B of A, Wells Fargo, Chase, what's the difference? There's none. Like are they really innovating on the product side to give you something differentiated? No, they're not. And partly because all the innovation and all that they compete on is size, balance sheet, risk, all the things behind the scenes that are important, but in our mind, not sufficient. So I think what's really exciting about the next iteration of banking or what banking ends up being is like, what does banking look like in 10 years from now? Like, should your bank actually understand your needs or your business's needs and actively help you manage and run your business, right? And how should it do so? And I think the challenge and the opportunity for companies like ours is we believe software is a large part of the equation. So until now, all the financial decision-making and intelligence lives in Excel and people. Like the spreadsheet is the workhorse of all financial intelligence, right? Like, so you might have a CFO or a financial analyst, and they're using Excel basically to come up with what you should do. And then that information is taken from there and manually input into money movement. You send wires, you know, you have ACH payments. And so in the future, we believe that software can actually help you in your decision-making, run your business better, run your business smarter. And in our view, the logical place for that to live is integrated into the banking stack, not as a standalone tool, but something that actually can help you with your decision-making and help you then with the money movement. So it's kind of a nuanced, I think, approach on how things might shape up, but that's kind of our view. And so I'm not sure I answered directly what's wrong with big banks. I think that
a lot of what you're saying started at, you know, after 2008, it became a too big to fail industry and everything's kind of controlled around that. So growth and innovation took a break for a while. I've seen it picking up. I mean, all their front end stuff is somewhat responsive, but I don't know about integration, you know. And it depends which market you're talking about. You guys are more SMB, of course, and you know, if you're talking about the big dog enterprise companies that are running on enterprise software, yeah, I don't see a lot of great integration there either. But anyway, without getting too geeky, how did you choose your target market? Because you know, we've had Brex on the program and some other you know, rapidly growing companies like you. And it's interesting that everyone's kind of picked a different swim lane. How'd you get to your spot?
Yeah, and part of it was born out of my experience in the previous startup. I was a part of AppNexus, which was an ad tech startup. But our customers were part of the wave of AT&T, AT&T. Yep. It was one of the earlier New York success stories, which was a very fun part to be ride to be part of. And so AppNexus was part of the first wave of kind of companies serving people selling goods online. So just as there was this tech ecosystem of startups, there was this Shopify and Amazon ecosystem of startups with people, you know, out of their garages building businesses selling physical goods online. And I got really interested in that segment because just as there was this entrepreneurial energy in tech startups, the same thing exists in that ecosystem. And they had the same sorts of issues where it was a very well-defined problem set. And for those businesses, finance is really mission critical because, you know, if you're running a working capital intensive, low margin business, if you don't get your cash cycle right, you're dead in the water pretty quick.
Totally.
So,
and you're right. Some of these weren't even businesses. They were just people like us. Even some of them didn't even have a garage. They're just selling stuff.
Yeah. Out of their apartment. Well, look at things like Etsy and Shopify and these platforms that allowed people to and Amazon allowed, like, you know, most of Amazon's GMV is third-party sellers. Like, I think 70% of their growth is not Amazon selling to you. It's a seller on Amazon selling to you.
And Walmart is right on their tail, putting billions into the same thing.
Right. And if you look at, like, the $7 trillion of U.S. GDP, like, you know, what percentage of that is going to end up being kind of mediated through these platforms, I think is only going to increase. So, like, already we're seeing probably close to a trillion of these omni-channel brands. And so that's the segment we're really focused on, is can we understand that selling of physical goods online really deeply and then help you run the finances for your business better?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And so cash flow is obviously king with these. What else have you figured out with these? Because it's a massive target market. Most people would say, oh, geez, you're just focusing on SMB. These are ones that need your help the most. But so besides cash flow, what other things are happening there? And is there a high failure rate in these types of companies still?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, I think we see it show up in stages. So, like, SMBs get painted with, like, a broad swath usually. But, like, from 0 to 1 million of sales, you're really trying to figure out, do I have a real business? Like, do I have something people want to buy?
Right.
But from 1 to 20 million, you're really figuring out, do I have a business that can scale effectively? And there your problems are more around operations and finance than they are around product. And I don't think people instinctively understand that. And so unless you came from an operating or finance background, that's where you hit the wall. And that's where, you know, cash, running out of cash is a symptom of other things going wrong, like how much can I afford to pay on inventory? Or how should I think about wholesale versus paying someone in 90 days versus paying someone today? And so a lot of what we're trying to do is build that basic discipline that if you had a really effective CFO in your corner, which you can't afford, but if you had that person, how would we replicate 75% of that in a way that can meaningfully change your business?
I like that.
And that's kind of what we've been working on.
That's smart, because if you look at the sector, it's like, because they can get a lot of what you're doing from big banks. They can get them from, I mean, I loved your what's wrong with the industry statement, because to me, the solving a lot of the too big to fail guys is the regional banks. They do still like you and know your name.
That's
and
right.
All that stuff, but they're not focused on this type of thing. So I'm kind of leading into competition. So is it really competitive for you guys out there? It seems like there's always a small list in fintech of people going after the same target. And personally, I like it when there's competition. It means you're in the right market, right place, right time, but also probably gives you a lot of pain.
Yeah, no, if there's not competition, this probably it's a warning sign that something is off. I think that what's interesting for us is our approach was kind of counterintuitive to a lot of fintech, which was most fintechs try to approach a business from the periphery and say, hey, we want you to start using our credit card, and then over time we'll expand our aperture and you'll use more and more stuff from us. Whereas we came at it as, look, we want you to switch your operating bank account over to us. And when we started the business, people were like, well, that's crazy. Like, common, you know, knowledge would say, you only get people, and most neobanks try to get businesses when they're really small because it's a pain to switch banks. Our idea was, it's a pain to switch banks, it is, but people will switch if the product is differentiated. So what we started off was saying, could we convince a business with $10 million in sales to move their operating bank account from a legacy bank to us? So who we view as competition is still very much the legacy banks. We see a lot of the usual suspects on the fintech side as competition, but I think most of them aren't coming at it from the angle of, the first thing I pitch you is, I don't really care. I don't want to lend you money. I don't want to give you a credit card. I want to be your banking partner, and I want you to move banks over to us. And that, you know, understandably, needs a lot of skepticism.
Expenses and stuff to start. There's so many expense companies now that doesn't seem.
That's right.
Doesn't seem like a differentiator.
Well, a lot of fintech was masquerading as tech when really they were just giving loans at slightly cheaper rates, right? And so I think we have to be honest with ourselves as an industry of like, what value are we really providing? And to me, the question is like, is there real differentiation in the software and the product that helps people make better decisions? If you're doing that and you can prove that there's some, you know, real value there, then there's probably some actual intrinsic value. Otherwise, it's just tough to make the statement that you're doing anything beyond just giving someone money.
So on competition, do you see, I don't know, let's just disrupt it here a little bit. Do you see like Shopify, Amazon, Walmart getting into this themselves?
You know, it's interesting.
Or Kroger, anyone with a marketplace, really, where they've got all these little
vendors. You know, Apple tried this, right? So yeah, like, I think there was right. there was a common prevailing kind of viewpoint that banking was going to go away and it was all going to become embedded in your existing platforms. Like Amazon will be your bank, Apple will be your bank, Shopify will be your bank. What we found is people actually don't want that. And not so much for the technical aspects of it, but also from a relationship and trust perspective. Like, they don't want to view Amazon as your bank. You're like, that's the person I trust to sell my products. It's kind of weird to have them manage my money. And so I think there's a
conflict of interest there.
Conflict as well as, I think, from a product, and it's such an important piece of the puzzle that it warrants something that's custom built solely for those needs. I really view it as, you need one true financial partner. So the interesting one for us is more as QuickBooks and Intuit. So, you know, your accounting and ledger system is the other kind of core financial partner that is the source of truth for your finances. Right. We view those as the two pillars of your finances, your bank and your ledger and accounting system. I think those will continue to be relationships that you want to maintain independently of any other relationship, at least at the business level. For the consumer level, maybe you could argue there's pieces that you could kind of consume, but I don't think at the business level.
Yeah, so we had the CEO of Intuit on. He's a big fan of the show. And I mean, that's a big one to go head-to-head with. I mean, they're in every country, tens of millions of, you know, everything from people in their garage to small companies. Do you see them more as a partner or a competitor? Or what's the landscape look like to you?
I think, well, you know, we'd be fortunate to consider them as a competitor at some point in the future, I think, when we hit their radar. But I think that
we will after this.
Well, I think that they view themselves probably as competing on multiple fronts, of which we are one. And so we'll partner in some ways and compete in others. Like, we're no interest in being the accounting, tax, ledger solution. Yep. They have banking and lending solutions. But I think also, like, the pie is so big here. Like, if you look at the top 5, 6, 7, or 100 US banks, like, where is that money going to flow through in the next 10 years? I think that, you know, Intuit could triple its flow of money through itself and still have more than enough room for people like ourselves. And so I think there's a lot more than one winner take all dynamic here. And hopefully we're part of that kind of story going forward.
Yeah. It was kind of a trick question. Cause when I talked to tech companies and tech leaders like myself, it's like, hey, enterprise, at the enterprise level, these big customers want to buy more products from less companies. It's just a pain otherwise, right? So you see a lot of consolidation, oligopolies. In finance, it seems, ever since 2008, go back to the 90s, really, but after the first bank failures, and there's always a cycle of bank failures, never going to stop, by the way, there's been this counter trend to say, no, don't put all your eggs in one basket, for gosh sakes, have a couple banks. So, you know, I still want to, you know, I still want to do High Beam, and I also want to leave, you know, a big boatload of cash over here at JP Morgan, whatever, yeah, whatever their lack of CFO person is thinking in the small groups. Do you see that as is that a blip, or is that just an ongoing trend where it's like, keep your bets spread out?
Yeah.
Cause I agree with you on the software.
It's a great question. Like,
hey, if you're my marketplace or you're my software vendor into it, and I don't also want you to be my bank. I mean, I'd love for you to help, but like, yeah, I want to put everything with you.
I think it's what we see more and more is there's one primary operating account. So that's where the money comes in, the smarts about how I move money in and out, and then I'll have multiple kind of capital holding accounts for various reasons. So I might have a treasury account at Fidelity for my excess cash. I might have a money market account somewhere else. I might have two or three bank accounts, but it's very hard to split the operating account across multiple banks. So for us, the North Star is like, really, if you hook up your payroll to us, we're pretty confident that we're your primary operating partner. And until you hook up your payroll to us, I don't consider you as, we've not won your business yet, you know? And so I think it's important to kind of, that's our North Star, is like, can we actually be the operating bank account for the business?
Does it have to be payroll? Or just what about merchandise floating for, you know, they're always buying and selling goods, right?
No, yeah, it's a great question. It's basically like, for these businesses, they're kind of flow businesses, right? Like lots of money coming in, lots of money going out. We want to be the source for both the money coming in from the Shopify or Amazon or Etsy, and then the money going out. Payroll is just kind of an indicator that it's, once you move that over,
they trust you.
That's usually the last thing. That's the last thing you move, because then that's the most important, you pay your people. And like, if that debit is on your bank account, you're pretty sure that they view you as the primary partner. Yep. So it's just kind of a proxy for that.
Yeah, I get that. So that's kind of where I was going. So I, you know, when I'm scaling companies, I look at build by borrow. I actually teach this at Kellogg and other places. You know, when you're trying to scale your company, there's a lot of things you built yourself. There's some things you might want to, you know, acquire later on. And yep, the whole borrowing side, yep, the partnership side, seems like a perfect strategy for you guys. How are you doing there in terms of using really amazing partnerships to scale at a much faster pace than like your competitors?
Yeah, and that's where, you know, I think the software-driven approach has to drive value on, if you can integrate through software with, let's just say through Plaid, with Amex or Bank of America or QuickBooks, and you can collect all this data that you didn't have access to before, yeah, what can you do meaningfully with that? And you don't have to do it yourself, you know? So even if I'm not the ledger, I can connect to QuickBooks, get the data, do something smart with it, and feed that back to the customer. I think what we're trying to say is, all these things that have to be done manually before, what can we do to automate that and not have to do everything ourselves? And that's kind of what the next iteration for fintech for me is really like, what are the platforms that, if you take like an example, look at AWS, right? Maybe when AWS arrives, it enables innovation because I don't have to, you know, put my own servers up, and I have a kind of defined standard that I can go build on, and there's innovation. I think fintech is similar, where you have certain standards now around tools like Plaid or Unit we use or Currency Cloud that allow you to now innovate without having to build this super capital intensive stack. So we can come up with a full blown banking product in a year and a half that even 3 years ago would have taken us a 10-year build. So the barriers to entry to build solutions like ours have admittedly gone down, which, to your earlier question, like, fosters competition and innovation and all of these things that has been kind of lagging in the sector in my mind for a long time.
Yeah. Wasn't Plaid acquired by Visa?
It was underway. And I think that one of them went through.
It was a multi-billion dollar transaction. But so when you look at partnerships, there's the product side to make your offering better. And then there's, you know, you seem like a good go-to-market person. So it's like, do you view your growth more on the, hey, we've got everything set up. We just need the go-to-market strategy to scale this to, you know, from tens and hundreds of millions to billions?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the partnership side for us is, there's a ecosystem of fractional CFOs, accountants, people already providing financial services to these companies that we want to empower. Like, if you're a fractional CFO, right, serving 10 of these customers, we want to make sure that if that person logs into High Beam, they can actually do their job better and easier. And so our go-to-market has been very much about how do we put ourselves in the center of the ecosystem of people that are already trying to provide financial advice and services to these companies. And that's kind of been what's worked. We try to build pretty strong relationships with those, the connective tissue of like fractional CFOs and accountants and existing lenders. And that's kind of our primarily how we've gone to market so far.
Yeah. Okay. Lots of expansion opportunities there. What about crypto? Doing anything there?
No, we've kind of kept it at arm's length, partly because
most of your customers,
for regulatory reasons.
Yeah, most of your customers probably don't care right now. They're just
trying to make- most of our customers don't care. And they're just trying to like, do I have enough cash to last the next quarter is usually their top of mind. So nothing on the horizon for crypto for right now.
What about AI? I know you do a lot of insights and analytics. Everyone talks up an AI story.
Yeah. But
are you slowly bringing it in or going with the
I think I think machine learning, of which I guess most LLMs about all the hype are like a subsegment of that.
Yep.
I think that for us, we definitely view the future of financial insights as machine learning based on large data sets of financial data. I think what you're trying to solve for with financial AI is very different than LLM AI, it's called the hype recently, because accuracy is key, right? And it's not like you can't afford to have someone make up something about what may or may not make you money in the next 2 months.
Yeah, it's down to the fraction of a cent or whatever currency you're in, yes.
Right. And so if the questions we get asked are, can I afford to spend $100,000 to hire someone to help me on marketing? Now, we believe that machine learning can help you answer that question. Huh. Do I think that the current LLMs and, you know, are the ones, is the right model? No, I don't. But I think you'll see a lot more innovation in the next 6 months and a year about like, what are the models that can really help with financial insights? And that's a huge part of our effort as well.
Yeah, makes sense. So what's been your biggest challenge for you and the team scaling this into a powerhouse, so to speak?
Yeah, honestly, I think that it's probably a twofold answer. One is the team and hiring and making sure we maintain. It's kind of a cliched answer, I guess, but like the finding great people. And we started the company right out of the pandemic, and you know, we made a decision early on to be kind of in person in the office. It was kind of, you know, our customers are all online, but we're kind of in the office. But I think that starting and building and growing a team that really wants to go achieve a mission mm-hmm. is always hard. And it's always maintaining a high bar when you know you have to hire. That's kind of like top of mind always. And that's kind of one large part of things. And the second is, you know, the bet we're making is requires part of the problem with if you're trying to build a bank, you're asking someone to trust you when you don't have necessarily a track record for them to trust. So if I'm pitching you and you run a $20 million in sales, you're like, I've never heard of you guys. Why would I trust you with my money to run all of my business? That's a hard sell. It's very different than, you know, try me out for a week and then see how it goes. So right. We focused a lot on what can we do for our first 20 customers so that the first year all we focused on was let's get 20 customers, get them to be super, super excited about what we've done, prove we can make them happy and successful for a year, and then we'll go and kind of now we'll go expand. And I think that in retrospect, it was tough because we don't have a lot of pressure to grow quickly, but I think it was the right call. So I think we're learning what it takes to maintain and manage that trust for what's admittedly like a hard thing for a startup to project, which is, you know, we're not a super old company. We don't have 100 years of history, but we want you to trust us as your bank.
So I just had some visions of JP Morgan, how old he would be right now today. But yeah, you guys are the young Turks, but you know, so was he one day, way back when, and they got someone to trust. And what I like about what you just said is their churn in your business is probably low because I don't want to unseat everything. If you're taking care of me, especially as a small vendor, selling a lot of products, got a lot of movement, I don't want to, you know, the barrier to entry, it feels like it's high. Am I reading that right?
No, that's exactly right. And like as much as you have to convince someone to move banks, if you can provide them with the value and a real differentiation of what they have, you have them hopefully for life, unless you mess things up. And that's really where if we can keep our customers, most of our go-to-market has come from customer referrals, because mm-hmm. there are these tight networks of people that are in it together that trust each other. And if you can kind of get a few people happy, they are more likely to kind of refer you to someone else. I do think also there's a bit of a moment in time right now where the large banks, by and large, if you are sub 100 million of sales, then I'll put this diplomatically, they care about you, but they don't care as much about you as they do about their larger customers. Like, I think
no,
like,
they call that down market. They call it down market. I mean,
they call it like stuff that we don't want to be in, maybe. I don't know. But
and Bank of America was famous for their CEO said, yeah, we're not, they didn't buy into all the early electronic banking, you know, when everything went to $1 billion valuations.
Right.
You know, I'm talking 5-10 years ago, they missed the first wave and said, no, those are little accounts. We don't care about that. Now they're all over it. All nine of the big banks are all over any size account now, because they want down market. They want, you know, cream of the crop wealth management, and they want the biggest.
Right. But I think
the smallest. But can they serve everybody?
Of course. That's exactly right. And can they serve it in a differentiated way when they have like this kind of, it's the same, you log into B of A, you're going to get the same experience, whether you're a restaurant or online business or a personal account. It's pretty much the same experience, because they can't afford to, you know, differentiate and kind of personalize it. And so it's an opportunity for us, we think, to really offer something compelling and different. Yeah. I do think, though, it's kind of like going from, you know, your gas car to your electric car, whatever the analogy is. Like, there's a shift. Once they move over to the next thing, hopefully they're on there for a while, because I think it's easier for us to make the case for someone to move over from a legacy bank than it would be from another neobank, for example. But most of our customers are still on legacy banking. It's not like there's some other fintech we're trying to displace here.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them are actually doing a good job with, you know, just the mobile experience is how they're trying to, you know, jump to the next level of UI UX. Then what last thing about them, the big nine, I call them, I think the CEO of Zelle is going to be on soon. And so that's one where they all came together, kind of a consortium, and you know, people are either, you know, a lot of people are hooked on it. It's just easy to send cash around. How does that impact your business? Especially small businesses.
Yeah, it's hugely important. And I think that, you know, the standardization of moving money around quickly with initiatives like FedNow and not getting too much in the weeds, like, you know, I think that there's standards and changes in how money will move that are coming online that will make the experience much, much better. Like, we're built on ACH and FedWire that was, you know, from the 70s and 80s on.
Like, yeah. It's like,
exactly, but that's still the backbone of money movement.
Exactly. Before that, it was like stagecoach. Yeah.
Someone with it's like a carrier pigeon and an abacus, and someone's writing a note. but I think that, yeah, exactly. So I think that there's opportunities for everyone to improve things. One thing we're very focused on is cross-border money movement. A lot of our businesses have international suppliers.
Cheap goods are bringing them in. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're buying leather from Italy because you're making bespoke jackets, you know, you're sending euros over. How do we do that effectively? How do we manage that relationship? You're selling in Italy now, you know, so everything is becoming cross-border as well.
Yeah.
And so we really view ourselves as facilitating that movement as much as the domestic movement.
Yeah, gotcha. So, Samir, I want to thank you for being on today. It was good. Any personal challenges, reboot stories that you went through on... You know, they really kind of impacted you. I've got some doozies, but they don't always turn out that well. But they always help people, I've noticed on our show here.
No, it's a great question. I think for me, part of the reason I started Hibeam was, you know, during the pandemic, right when the pandemic hit New York, was when our son was born. Actually, it was the week when they weren't allowing fathers into the hospital. So this crazy story where I like dropped my wife off at the delivery center and came back 2 days later and met my son in the parking lot. And it was, I think it was a kind of reflection for me of what I want to do in life and what's my priorities. And I'd always imagined myself starting a company and wanting to do that. But I felt in some ways that that ship had sailed and that I wasn't going to have the time and energy to devote to this in a way to really make it successful. I think that the learning for me really was there's trade-offs with everything and everyone has limited time and energy, but if you can really decide and ruthlessly prioritize how you want to spend your time and energy, there's enough to go around to be successful in the things you want it to be. And that for me is like, you know, Hibeam and family, But in some ways, I feel like I get to be more productive and energized now than I was before, you know, family, kids, all that stuff. And even probably more productive at work, not because necessarily, I used to think that if I wasn't grinding, you know, X number of hours every day, I was not doing my job. And I felt like that's just not enough. And I still feel, of course, you have to put the hours in, but it's so much more important to have the time and energy to put into, you know, pieces of work that are meaningful that you can kind of devote yourself to. And so I've done more things like I got off social media and things that were just, you know, while they're important, they just were time sucks. And I just got to ruthlessly prioritize. And I feel like that act of ruthlessly prioritizing time and energy actually helped me first realize what I cared about, but second, be more productive than the kind of, I'll just grind and try my best and that's what I'm going to work towards. So I don't know if that answers your question directly, but yeah, I feel like for me, that feels like, you know, I'm much more conscious now. And as I get older, you know, I only have so much time and so much energy. So it's like, how do I devote that effectively on things that are important to me? And that's where I think a lot more about than I did maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. It's a good lesson for execs as well as founders. It's like people always think, well, I'm going to start this company while I'm single. But actually you were married, you had a kid. It was crazy for you. And you actually became a more thoughtful leader probably because you have to learn to prioritize your time and not just work in the office for 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And that's
what it's and you know about. What? And one thought that came to that, I think part of it is the emotional foundation to have to be able to work off, to be able to buffer the stresses that come from being a founder. And I think that when I was single, I don't know if I probably had more time in some ways, but I didn't have the emotional buffer or foundation to be able to kind of course correct and withstand the ups and downs as much. And some people obviously might be different than me, but that's why I think for me, counterintuitively, the right time was probably after kids versus before kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds good. Good advice. You've been listening to Samir Shagril. He is the CEO of Hybeam. This is Dean Tobias with the Reboot Chronicles. I want to thank you for joining us today. We'll see you all soon.